100 years ago today, on the 14th of March 1921, it was a day of violence in Dublin City. In fact, it was the worst day of political violence in the capital since Bloody Sunday, 21st of November 1920, 4 months earlier. To talk about this, I'm joined by historian John Dorney, editor of theirishstory.com and a presenter of the Irish History Show podcast. John, you're very welcome indeed to the programme.
Happy to be here.
So, on the 14th of March 1921, at 25 past 8 that morning, news of the executions of six IRA volunteers was read to a large crowd gathered outside Mountjoy Jail. Why exactly were these six men hanged?
Well, there were five of the six were members of the Active Service Unit, the full-time, very small full-time corps of the Dublin Brigade of the IRA, and they had been caught in an ambush in Drumcondra in January. It was one of the first actions of the ASU. They were being hanged under martial law. It was a military trial. Unlike in Cork, say, there wasn't a summary military trial. Like, for example, in February, six IRA men were executed in Cork, you know, after being court-martialed the same day. Now, in Dublin, wasn't under that kind of martial law. It was under the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act. So it was a bit more prolonged. It was out in the open. There was a lot of time for drama to build up. One other of the men, Patrick Moran, was being charged with his involvement in Bloody Sunday. He was actually involved in the killings on Bloody Sunday. He was involved in killing two British officers, or one possibly not British officer, but in the Gresham Hotel on O'Connell Street. But he was charged actually with another killing, which he wasn't involved in. Patrick Moran had the chance to escape with Ernie O'Malley and Simon Donnelly from Kilmainham Jail, but turned down the chance on the basis that he thought he would get off in the trial because he was, you know, being charged with the wrong murder, effectively. But no, he didn't get off, and they were all hanged that morning in Mountjoy.
And a lot of people were waiting for news of the hanging, literally thousands of people, apparently.
Yeah, so certainly after the news of the hanging came out, and possibly before, because people hoped for a reprieve, I think up to 40,000 people gathered outside Mountjoy. There was very striking scenes of particularly women kneeling and saying the rosary. There was a very large military cordon, you know, with troops in combat gear with steel helmets and fixed bayonets. The RAF were ordered to buzz the crowd, not to bomb the crowd now, but to fly low over the crowd to intimidate them. So, yeah, it was a very public, very, very tense scene. Also, the Labour movement later that day called a one-day general strike in protest, and the IRA went around the city encouraging businesses to close. I mean, what the IRA accounts say is that many of them went along with it anyway, you know, out of loyalty to the Republic, but the IRA made sure that they did as well. But it does go against the perception of the War of Independence, especially in Dublin, as being a small-scale clandestine thing by a few men, particularly with guns. It's really much broader than that. You know, it's a big kind of public engagement with these events.
Now, there was a British-imposed curfew in place at the time, which came into effect at 9 p.m. each night. But at 144 Pierce Street, at the time known as Great Brunswick Street, not that far away from the headquarters of G Division of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, the IRA were planning retaliation, or at least a unit of the IRA was planning retaliation. Tell me about this unit.
Well, the unit was a company of 3rd Battalion of the Dublin Brigade, and the Dublin Brigade had, well, it had 6 battalions in total, but in the city it had 4 battalions, 2 north of the river and 2 south of the river, in the opposite way to the postcodes, which we might associate now, so it sometimes gets confusing in that way, but like 2 battalion is north of the River Liffey and 3 battalion is south of the River Liffey, so the opposite of the postcode. But the orders given to IRA units, IRA companies, so the rank and file of the Dublin IRA, the part-time volunteers, if you like, was that they were to go out and retaliate, to go out and carry out some sort of attack on Crown forces. So this particular company of 3rd Battalion met there in 145 Great Brunswick Street, which was at the time a Catholic hall. This was where they would have paraded. Now, an IRA parade by this date, 1921, doesn't mean marching up and down. What it means is a secret meeting, you know, in a safe house where you go and you get the weapons out of the dumps and you try to go out and carry out some sort of shooting or bombing. Usually they'd homemade hand grenades. And that's what they did. They went out, they got their revolvers and their hand grenades. There was an attack on a police station on Marion Square, but the bomb seems to have bounced off the police station and it badly injured, blew off the leg of one volunteer, Sean Dowling. Now, the company was like regrouping, perhaps like debriefing, saying what went wrong in 144 Great Brunswick Street. When word appears to have reached the auxiliary police, so the famous auxiliaries, that they were there and that their weapons were there.
And this was the famous, or the infamous, F Company, which was based in Dublin Castle of the Auxiliaries, a greatly feared unit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the War of Independence is colloquially known as the Black and Tan War and so on, but the Black and Tan, strictly so-called, were recruits into the RIC, and they have a very mixed record. Like, some of them didn't do very much. Some of them were quite brutal. But the real, you know, feared auxiliary police were the auxiliary division of the RIC. Better equipped, better armed, not just drafted into the RIC like the Black and Tans, but their own units. F Company in particular, were responsible, for example, for the summary execution of Dick McKee and Patrick Clancy and Conor Clune on the night of Bloody Sunday. So, you know, just torturing them, it appears, because they had bayonet wounds, and beating them and then shooting them out of hand. You know, they were quite a feared unit.
So presumably they were tipped off that there was a company of IRA in 144 Pier Street, or Great Brunswick Street as it was then.
Yeah, it looks that way, Miles. What the IRA report said, IRA report was actually later captured by the British, said was that an ex-soldier by the name of Stephen Clark was acting as a spy, and the IRA knew about this. They were already tracking him. And what the IRA certainly thought was that Stephen Clark led the auxiliaries to the company meeting place on the day of the ambush. Now, as we'll probably get on to discussing, Stephen Clark was actually killed when fire broke out. But, you know, he might have been targeted anyway, because the IRA certainly suspected that he was behind the auxiliaries finding the company headquarters.
So the F Company of the Auxies, or at least part of F Company of the Auxies, arrive in force on Pier Street with a Rolls-Royce armoured car and two tenders. What happens then?
So the auxiliaries arrived to raid the place. Now, you know, it appears, as we said, that they were acting on intelligence, but it wasn't like, say, a SWAT raid, for example, we might envisage today, you know. They were investigating it. So they arrived on the scene. When they did, the IRA company inside opened fire. So it was the IRA that initiated contact, to use military terms. So initially, like, there was eight auxiliaries in the first lorry. This is the unarmoured Crossley tender, as opposed to the Rolls-Royce armoured car. But five of them out of eight were hit, you know, by the small arms fire from the house. But the auxiliaries, you know, they had a heavy machine gun mounted in the Rolls-Royce armoured car. They had rifles. They had probably Lewis machine guns themselves. And so they greatly outgunned the IRA. Now, there was a pretty brief gun battle. It was a gun battle of about 5 minutes, which actually is very long by Dublin standards in the War of Independence, but, you know, very short in the scheme of things. And by the end of it, eight people, and we now know, were killed or mortally wounded.
Now, apportion the casualties or the fatalities, if you would. Some were civilians, some were auxiliaries, some were IRA.
Yeah, so two IRA men or volunteers were killed. One of them was an 18-year-old from Dundalk by the name of Bernard O'Hanlon, and he was shot outside 145. So he may have been outside the building when the firing broke out. He'd fired two rounds from a revolver, and he was hit multiple times. Another one was Leo Fitzgerald. Leo Fitzgerald came from a distinguished kind of Republican rank-and-file family. Like, his brother was senior in the Fianna. His first name was Theobald Wolfe Tone Fitzgerald, Miles. That'll give you an idea, I would say, of the family's sympathies. They were killed instantaneously. Another three, I think, IRA men were wounded. And them, along with Sean Dowling, who was injured in the earlier incident, the grenade incident, were spirited away by Cumnock Man women, who also took the weapons and the papers from the house to Mercer Street Hospital, where they were, you know, treated in secret by sympathetic medical people. The rest of the IRA company made their escape around the houses. There wasn't any arrests made, apart from one, who we'll get on to. But there was, we now know, three civilians killed or fatally wounded. One of them was actually the brother of a Sinn Féin MP, Thomas Kelly. There was a caretaker of one of the buildings was killed. Stephen Clark, who was the ex-soldier, 22 years old, who we now think may have been the informer who was working with the auxiliaries, he was killed when fire was opened. I just read this morning, actually, there was an elderly woman by the name of Mary Hogan who was killed, and she died of her wounds 1 month later in April 1921.
And two members of F Company lost their lives as well?
Right, two members of F Company, one of whom was the driver, Farrell, who was an Irishman. So, you know, not all the auxiliaries in Black and Tans were from Britain, some of them were Irish. And another auxiliary, a war veteran by the name of Beard, were killed, and I think five more wounded, of whom three were sent to hospital.
And apparently the command of the company, the IRA company involved, was not pleased that this action had taken place.
Well, not the company, Miles, the battalion, so a bit higher up the scale. So Joe O'Connor, who was the commandant of 3rd Battalion, which, as I said, was the South Inner City area, and along with 2 Battalion on the north side were the two most active battalions. He wrote later on that, you know, this was an example of what not to do as an urban guerrilla. Said, so, you know, we were very poorly armed. I mean, according to British figures, for example, only 1 in 4 of the brigade had access to any kind of weapon. And the weapons they did have were usually handguns and improvised grenades. And what not to do was to get involved in the stand-up fight. So John O'Connor, for example, was of the opinion that, you know, if the safe house was being raided, the prudent thing was to get away, take away the arms and the papers, and just melt away. The prudent thing was not to get involved in a stand-up fight with forces who were much better armed and who could call reinforcements very, very quickly in the city centre. So, you know, Collins also, at the very top of the IRA, was very insistent on this point, especially in Dublin, there was to be no stand-up fights. And it was the same thing that went wrong in the Customs House raid a little bit later, but, you know, on a smaller scale, perhaps.
Attacks, though, continued in Dublin in the week following the 14th of March. So it would appear that the IRA was keen to exact some revenge for the executions in Mountjoy early on the morning of the 14th of March.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not just a question of revenge for the executions. I mean, by this point, the IRA campaign in Dublin is, you know, it's set. They set up the ASU in late 1920. The idea is to, you know, carry out the maximum amount of small attacks in the city. And it's tied in with the political struggle, really. It's to demonstrate that the, you know, British control of the capital is being disputed. Even if you can't do much from, you know, a strictly military nature, you can, if you like, give the appearance of a war zone, you know, which is important from a political point of view. But to answer your question, Miles, about the attacks, yeah, so for the following day, for example, a British soldier was shot and killed at Rialto Bridge, which in those days is just outside the city centre. 3 days later, there's an attack on a troop convoy in Dorset Street on the north side. The day after that, in one of the largest single attacks in terms of fatalities, there's 3 soldiers, British soldiers, killed and 5 wounded in a grenade attack on Wexford Street. So, yeah, certainly the attacks went on.
Now, to get back to the Pierce Street attack, there were 2 IRA men captured as they fled the scene of the battle. They didn't all manage to get away. Tell me about those 2 men, one of whom was extremely young, and what happened to them?
Well, one of them, as you say, Joseph Donnelly, was 17 years old, and he survived the period. I mean, he only had to survive a few more months because the truce came in July 11th, 1921. The other one, though, was Thomas Traynor, who was a 40-year-old married man. He was the father of 10 children, originally from Tullow, County Carlow. He had been involved in the Rising of 1916, and he was found that day with an automatic pistol. The pistol had fired no shots, you know, for the record. And what Thomas Traynor said was he had been involved in the Volunteers, yes. I think he'd been interned after 1916, but he was no longer involved, and he was bringing the weapon back to the dump for the Volunteers, but he hadn't been involved in the ambush. There was a quite protracted trial. He was defended by Michael Noick, who was a lawyer who was in the service of the Republican movement. And to no avail, Thomas Traynor was hanged later that month. He was convicted, I think, of levying war against the Crown forces, and he was hanged in Mountjoy Jail on April the 25th. Now, Joseph Donnelly was spared either because he was too young or possibly just he got lucky and the truce intervened.
But there was another death consequent on all of this because of the execution of Traynor, wasn't there?
Yeah, and it kind of shows the cycle of violence, Miles, that the War of Independence kind of embodied. So yeah, I mean, by this point, the British were executing IRA volunteers with reasonable regularity. I mean, not as many as the, you know, the following year, actually in the Civil War, the following 2 years. But the IRA reacted to British formal executions by saying, well, some of your personnel fall into our hands and we will kill them. We will execute them in retaliation. So that's what happened. There was an RIC district inspector by the name of Gilbert Potter who was being held at the time by the IRA, and he was shot or he was executed in retaliation for the execution of Thomas Traynor.
Now, there was a sequel to all of this in 2001. I remember it quite well. And it involved the exhumation of remains of IRA men in Mountjoy who had been hanged and their transfer to Glasnevin Cemetery. And I think a number of the people who died on that day were included in that group.
Yeah, so we started speaking, Miles, at the start of the interview about the 6 men who were hanged in Mountjoy on the morning of March 14th, 1921. And they were among the what's now known as the Forgotten 10, who were reinterred and they were reburied in Glasnevin in the year 2001. And so was Thomas Traynor, for that matter, who was executed as a consequence of the ambush.
There was a certain amount of scepticism, I recall, at the time surrounding the transfer of these 10 bodies.
Yeah, Well, you know, I mean, one reading of it that was, it's been expressed to me is that, you know, it was a long running campaign. There was, had been an 80 year campaign, first of all, to identify the graves because they were buried in unmarked graves inside the prison walls. And then later on, you know, to exhume them and to reinter them in the Republican plot in Glasnevin. So that's one reading. Another reading at the time was the then Taoiseach Bertie Ahern had a general election coming up, and he had a Fianna Fáil Ardéis around the same time. And that this was an attempt to kind of reassert Fianna Fáil's kind of Republican credentials. I mean, another thing Bertie Ahern did, this is kind of post-peace process era, of course, is that he reinstated for a time the Easter parade in commemoration of the Easter Rising, which had been stopped during the Northern Troubles. So a somewhat cynical interpretation of the reinterment of the Forgotten Ten would be that it was, you know, an attempt to recapture the Republican history of Fianna Fáil by Bertie Ahern. But the other interpretation being, of course, that it was the culmination of a long-standing campaign.
Yeah, well, we don't tolerate cynicism on the History Show, John. So,
I should hope not.
But thank you. Thank you for pointing out the cynicism of others on that particular occasion. John Doherty, thank you very much indeed. The 14th of March, 100 years ago today, an eventful day. A fateful day indeed in the War of Independence. And my guest, John Dorney, is the author of two books, The Civil War in Dublin and Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution 1912 to 1924, which has just been re-released, as it happens, in paperback. John, many thanks again for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thank you very much.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Logan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.